Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Greetings from the Hill Country of Central Texas. This is Revolution of Military Affairs, and I'm your host, Amos Fox.
Okay, thanks for joining the Revolution of Military Affairs podcast again today. We have an exceptional guest. I'm extremely excited about the guest we have today. We've got Henry Langston on. He was formerly associated with Vice News, where he did reporting in Ukraine on the Russo-Ukrainian War from before it actually got started to basically when Minsk II was signed. And he was there, I would say, at all the key points along the way, all the key battles along the way. So just an invaluable resource here to help us understand the conflict that's happening right now. By looking at how it started in the beginning. And so with that, Henry, just thank you very much for your time. And I'm happy that you're willing to sit down and talk with me today.
Of course. No, thank you for having me.
All right. So we talked a bit beforehand, before we started recording, on the dates that you were involved in the conflict. So you initially got in there in December of 2013, and you left, and these are all intermittent visits, but you left in the late summer of 2015. So you saw all the big pieces of the conflict to that point. So first battle of Donetsk Airport, Ilovaisk, the battle of Donetsk Airport part two, which is a significant battle, and then the battle of Debaltseve. So these are things that most people like myself haven't been able to see but have studied intensely. And so this is why, again, just a little backstory here. This is one of the things when I did my master's thesis at the School of Advanced Military Studies, I did it on Russian hybrid warfare and the Russo-Ukrainian War. And so I came upon Henry's work as part of my research for that. So I was writing my thesis in 2016, 2017. And so there wasn't a lot of information available at that time to find out what was going on. And so as I dug around, Henry's work kept coming to the fore, and Henry's reporting for Vice News kept coming to the fore. And so that's the backstory to why we have him on here. And he's one of the few people that was really there and got to see a lot of this. So these are just really important and interesting things that I want to talk about today. So this is one of those episodes where everybody's got to bear with me as I nerd out on just talking about this conflict in this period specifically, because it's so unique, I think. So I guess first question, your reporting during that time period during the Donbas campaign was from the DNR side of things. Given what we know about Russia's involvement today from that time period, how prevalent were they really throughout that period, that 2014 to early 2015 period?
So I think something like, prevalence of Russian forces in a kind of really overt way is quite hard to, I suppose, quantify. I think there are obviously key moments and key figures that obviously hinted hinted at that pretty early on when you have figures like Gherkin operating in Slovyansk, and then before that in Crimea. So, you know, we know his background in sort of Russian military, has a Russian military background, and you sort of skip ahead to moments like the shooting down of MH17 with a Buk launcher, you know, that was not stolen from, you know, Ukrainian ammo sources or whatever, you know, that came across the border, you know, great reporting by Bellingcat and others to sort of track that down. So, you know, there were these moments that kept sort of popping up that it was right there in front of you. But obviously, you know, engaging with these characters or you know, you see interviews with these types, it's not like they're going to admit that they're operating, you know, with direct orders from, you know, the Russian military or Putin himself. So I think, you know, everyone knew there that there was Russian involvement from the very beginning, but how that worked out and kind of was obviously difficult to sort of tell on the ground. But you kept seeing these same figures with Russian connections popping up in positions of power and control, you know, in places like Slovyansk and Donetsk, and the Buk launcher at MH17, the Battle of Ilovaisk being a key moment where it was pretty obvious that Russian forces had to be involved in one way or another. You start looking at, you know, the battle for Donetsk airport, you know, through the winter of 2014 into 2015, and you know, then it's pretty obvious.
Quite clear. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So very hard in the moment, you know, to sort of be able to say 100% that this is being directed from Moscow, but you know, all the evidence there around you was pointing in that direction.
Yeah, that's so when you did most of your reporting, you were embedded with the DNR, correct?
So early 2014, the first trip we did to, or the first, my first trip to the Donbass, which May the 1st, you know, we were what front lines there were, we were crossing back and forth between them almost every other day. So, you know, we would film with separatist militants one day, and then the next you're crossing over and you're traveling 50 miles and you're filming with the Donbass battalion, pro-Ukrainian militia, made up of sort of veterans and civilians who decided to take up arms with a bit of financial backing, to basically take the fight to the DNR in and around Donetsk. So it's really tricky, right? Because you're passing checkpoints, you're going from side to side, and both sides hate each other, and you know, you're constantly being questioned about where are you going, what are you filming. So that was a challenge. But yeah, we tried as much as we could whilst we would often base ourselves in Donetsk, because obviously that's where a lot of activity was taking place, and that was a good base to get down to Mariupol or other parts of the Donbass that were heating up. So we tended to be based there, but often we would travel and sort of film with on the Ukrainian side of things too.
Yeah, so a bit of a nuanced question based off that, and what you mentioned separatists, and I know we've talked about Russia's involvement here. How much of this was genuinely a separatist movement, and how much of this was a Russian proxy war strategy to undermine Ukrainian sovereignty in the region? And is that something that you were able to really figure out at that point?
I think it can be both. Like, I think there is a fair portion of people in that part of Ukraine that looked east for lots of things. The telly that they would pick up, you know, was Russian channels, the radio, the party of regions, which was Yanukovych's party, was obviously very popular there. And so there was a lot of pro-Russian sentiment amongst the population. But I think what gets washed out from that time is that there was also a lot of pro-Ukrainian sentiment too, but it became too dangerous, obviously, to be overtly pro-Ukrainian. So many left if they could. And obviously, if you look at reporting from people like Chris Miller and others around that time, you know, it was a deadly thing to be pro-Ukrainian in the Donbass at that time. So, I think there are the idea that there's no pro-Russian, genuine pro-Russian sentiment, separatist sentiment in that part of the world at that time. I mean, that's untrue. There definitely was, there was no way that the situation ended up like it did without support from Russia itself, militarily or clandestinely through other kind of intelligence outfits. So I think it's definitely both. You know, we talk about hybrid warfare, and you know, mm-hmm. I think that's the kind of the classic case in many ways. The fog of war was very heavy there, but that was the point. And that also was a challenge for journalists and journalism there is to try and to decipher really what was going on, who was in charge, who is who, was really difficult on the ground at the time. But I think that was by design in many ways.
Oh, absolutely. So with that, I think I'm going to jump to a future question, and then I'm going to come back in time and talk about 2014, 2015 again. So based off that assessment and that support for Russia that existed in those areas there in Donetsk and Luhansk and all the way down through that land bridge to Crimea, looking at the conflict today, if let's just say that Ukraine was able to liberate those areas, do you think that support for Russia would still exist, does still exist, might cause an insurgency? What are your thoughts on that based off the situation right now?
It's a great question. I, you know, without having really been there and being able to test the war, I would say an insurgency, I think, would probably be unlikely. I imagine that people there are just exhausted. This conflict has been so cataclysmic in every which way. I don't see something, a genuine insurgency. I would be really surprised if there was enough kind of love for Russian governance in those areas, if they were to be liberated, to then foment into a genuine sort of insurgency. I highly doubt it, basically. I think everyone would likely be exhausted and just desperate for some sense of peace and normality.
I think that's a good point, because you know, when you look at the conflict now and you look at the conflict in the 2014-2015 period, that like the Donbass and Donetsk in particular has taken a heavy amount destruction. It's been like the epicenter of much of the fighting for this whole time period. Like right now, Avdiivka is about to fall, and it's all but flattened too, you know. And so, yeah, that makes perfect sense. The people there, I'm sure, are exhausted because they've been doing a lot of the heavy lifting.
I would not. Life there must be awful. Must be really, really difficult. No matter how. Whatever they might think of Russia and Putin, etc., life cannot be easy for the vast majority of people in areas under Russian control. Yeah, and it's been a long 10 years.
Yeah, for sure. People there. So with that, I'd just like to ask you a couple questions about some of the key battles that I know you were there for, and just see if you have some insights from each one of those. So first we'll hit Ilovaisk, and then Donetsk Airport, and then Debaltseve. So is there anything interesting or unique or something you think that the public should be aware of that they probably aren't as it relates to each of those battles?
Wow, that's a good question. I mean, I think what struck me, so I'll probably start with actually the battle for Donetsk Airport, because it sort of started right at the end of May 2014. And I think like the absurdity of war, I think, often gets overlooked in many, many ways. I know that's might seem an odd answer, but just literally upon reflecting back to that day, the whole thing was absurd. And there were things that just didn't really make a lot of sense that kept popping up. And, you know, when we arrived, you know, basically pro-Russian forces had turned up at the airport intending to turf out Ukrainian troops that had been there. There'd been sort of this standoff situation there for the previous month. It was sort of seen as a part of the city that was you know, the separatists might leave alone because of the Ukrainian army presence. And I think they were trying to feel each other out, you know, in the kind of previous 2 months. But they turned up, they picked a fight, they got one.
Yeah.
Ukrainians landed troops via helicopter, I believe, and Ukrainian, I think it's a fighter bomber. I wouldn't be able to identify the jet necessarily used off the top of my head. But, you know, so this was a clear escalation, you know, like there'd been these sort of hit and run raids and clashes. Obviously, there had been some fighting around Slavyansk and Kramatorsk, but Donetsk had been sort of spared this kind of brutal fighting. But then it was, you know, from that day onwards, it was the gloves were off, you know.
Yeah.
You know, attack helicopters coming in, flying over our heads, and, you know, small arms fire from the ground, trying to take it out. And we're literally just walking down this approach road to the airport, and it's, you know, deathly silent, but there's like crowds watching what's going on. You don't expect that, you know, in a battle. Yeah. Right. And we're sort of walking through down, trying to get close to the airport to try and understand what's going on. And this old gentleman kind of walks out onto the road. He's got this big cross in his hand. He's got a Bible, and he's just sort of basically doing the sign of the cross, you know, just at anyone that was there. And you're just like, get the hell out of here. Like, what are you doing? This is like, incredibly dangerous. There's RPGs going off, there's sniper fire.
Yeah.
You know, we get thrown into a sort of trench, well, not a trench, like a ditch with these DNR fighters that got pinned down. We got shot at by snipers, and, you know, they're shouting and screaming at each other. They're kind of annoyed. You know, it's just like the absurdity of the situation. You know, we were supposed to drop off our hire car at this airport like in 2 days' time, and that wasn't possible clearly anymore. Yeah. So we were like, where are we going to fly from? These kind of absurd moments kind of pop into your head. And where we parked the car previously was now in no man's land. So we had to try and figure out a way of getting it back without being shot at.
Or without getting charged a late fee.
Yeah. I mean, they were very they were very accommodating, actually, the hire car company, when we dropped off in a completely different city, just about in one piece. But yeah, I think the absurdity of the opening day really kind of just made the event even more weird and challenging, and obviously it was a brutal fight, and we came upon the aftermath of it the day later. We went to the morgue and saw, you know, what happened to a group of separatist fighters who'd been attacked. They were driving towards the airport and had been attacked, and yeah, it was pretty horrific. And this was, you know, there's civilian housing all around the airport, and you know, this now became a front line, and it really shook people up, because I think they sort of thought that Donetsk might be okay, but yeah, if you were living on the outskirts of that city, that was no longer the case.
One of the big things that I noticed from your reporting and other reporting from that time was you talk about the outskirts of the city, and like I don't know if I'm saying it right. Pisky? How do you say it?
I've always said Pisky, but I've probably been saying it wrong, so apologies.
But that town, which was like a small town, but it's still a town, was basically eviscerated in the fighting, and it changed hands multiple times because it was used as a support base, because it was, what, about 2 miles outside the airport?
If that, yeah. Yeah, it was, I've been to Pisky now, I want to say 2 or 3 times, I think.
Yeah.
And absolute devastation. Obviously now it's fallen under fully Russian control, unfortunately.
Yeah.
But it was a kind of a nice little village. I mean, it's barely a town, really. It was kind of a village. Lots of kind of holiday homes, I believe. You know, it was a pretty spot, some water nearby. And yeah, just completely flattened. I think that was the thing about this conflict and the way it was fought, is just to flatten everything in front of you, both sides just launching as much artillery at each other as possible. And I think from a Western perspective, that was unusual for us as audiences to other conflicts, you know, obviously Iraq, Afghanistan, insurgencies, and kind of some obviously fierce urban combat, if Fallujah is one to go by, but we weren't used to seeing this kind of warfare play out. And, you know, it's just so unforgiving for everyone caught underneath it, whether it's soldiers or civilians. That's obviously something to this day that is a real signifier of this conflict, is that from the very get-go, it's civilians that have been caught in the middle of it. and it's just been awful, been completely merciless. And
yeah, one of the things that I've found somewhat surprising is based off that, right, that 2014-2015 way that the war went, which is well documented, especially at this point, and especially before 2022. And having written a bunch about this conflict, that's one of the things that I've always tried to put out there is, hey, like the flattening of cities is not an anomaly. This is how some people fight, right or wrong, or however, you know, you may think it's the wrong way to do things. But this is how things go. And so I was invited to a conference at Harvard. What was it? At the tail end of March. So I was invited like back before, you know, like November, December for this conference in March at Harvard. And this would have been December of 2021. And so, you know, I got, you know, I decided to go to the conference and do a presentation. And I was talking about urban warfare and sieges in urban warfare, right? And so one of the, like, my big thing was, leading up to this was I was talking about Ilovaisk, Donetsk Airport, and Debaltseve, and that was the crux of my argument. And then, you know, Russia invades Ukraine in February 2022. I go to this conference at the tail end of March at Harvard, and it's with Harvard, the ICRC, the International Committee of the Red Cross, and the Lieber Institute out of West Point, which is a humanitarian law department within the school. And it was talking about the legality of sieges in modern war and sieges in general. And it was fascinating because I was like the token combat arms individual in this audience or in this group of people at this conference. And then it was all lawyers aside from me. Wow. And so I was supposed to kind of be the foil. I was invited to be the foil in this conversation. And it was fascinating because all these lawyers in the room were talking about how, well, it's illegal and they can't do this. And I'm like, okay, that sure, but they do.
Yeah,
and there was this And there was this misunderstanding of where lawyers exist within military formations, and they all seem to be under the assumption that lawyers existed at the most finite tactical level units, and they were, you know, cautioning, don't do that. And I was like, no, like in the U.S. military, lawyers only exist at the brigade level and up.
Right.
And so brigade headquarters aren't really out there doing the fighting necessarily. And so the lawyer is detached from fighting. And that's just in the U.S. side. So I'm sure the Ukrainian army and the Russian army, the situation's slightly different. And so I was just taken back by the fact that so many people seemed so shocked when all this was going on. And so at the time when I was doing this presentation, Mariupol was just, you know, was firing up at that point, and the siege of Mariupol was going on. And so it was useful because I was like, look, here's the historical precedent on both these armies, and here's what's really happening right now. And so I think that that's part of the problem is like the royal we here, whoever that is, we tend to think that like these types of fights like Ilovaisk, Donetsk Airport, Debaltseve are anomalies in warfare. And really, I don't think that they are.
No, I think it's just also it's modern warfare, right? You have to take and hold population centers, and they are heavily, obviously, urbanized, and they contain a lot of people. That I think any army will try and engage in that kind of fighting. You know, we'll be drawn into cities one way or another. You know, you can't pick your place of battle anymore. It's not the War of the Roses. You don't get to sort of pick a field in Yorkshire.
Line up in sequential lines. And
like that, over time, battles and warfare have been increasingly drawn to urban centers. That's not to say that armies shouldn't obviously try to operate under Geneva Conventions and avoid civilian casualties at all cost. But it will happen, and it will continue to happen, unfortunately. And this is why I think in many ways the reemergence of this war in Ukraine, this reinvasion or the second invasion of Ukraine by Russia, is so tragically sad, because we saw this coming years ago. We were warned that this was all very possible and very likely, but real failure in hard and soft diplomacy allowed a situation to ferment where it just was only seemingly a matter of time for Russia to sort of make its move. And I think, a lot of missed opportunities diplomatically to try and ensure that didn't happen. But in terms of other those other battles that you mentioned, Ilovaisk was the conflict, the battle itself, we weren't able to get to and cover because of its ferocity. Ukrainian troops and volunteer forces trapped within the city itself, and essentially having to negotiate a surrender. And then obviously
that didn't go well.
No, there was this supposed green corridor. You know, they were under the impression, and I think they were promised safe exit.
Yep.
But then I think it was just too much of a good opportunity by separatist and Russian forces to wipe out, you know, a large group of Ukrainian soldiers.
Yep.
You know, an incredibly horrendous act of warfare. And, you know, we came upon that aftermath. And I think, you know, what we saw, I think, was a real stark reminder of just the horrific brutality of conflict. I think, you know, we in Western countries are thankfully protected often, you know, from seeing what warfare really looks like, what it feels like, what it smells like. And we're very lucky for that. And we shouldn't, you know, for me, coming across moments like that, it's a real reminder of how fortunate we are and how important, you know, democracy is and should be protected, and how diplomacy is incredibly invaluable to try and stop any form of conflict from happening at all.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us. Mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
The sheer scale and madness and brutality of it. I think, you know, just, I think every time I'd come across something like that in Ukraine in, you know, 2014 or 2015, I just kept having to sort of remind myself that this is Europe. This is, you know, this is not some far away place. Not that it makes it any better if it was, but like, this is a country in Europe that, not long before the fighting started in Ukraine, hosted the European football championships. You know, Donetsk was a host city, you know, had a brand new football stadium that hosted international sporting events. The English football team played there. This was a European city, a European country that had been invaded, and there was this brutal conflict going on. But it seemed there was such a, by so many in power, to sort of deny that and to try and minimize what was going on, because it was inconvenient for them. At least that's how I felt personally. But
can I jump in on that really quick?
Yeah.
Yeah. So that, to me, that's one thing. So what got me started and got my interest perked in this was that it was underreported in the U.S. The conflict was underreported. Every now and then on CNN or something, you'd see like, hey, there's, you know, the separatist fighting, and then they jump to whatever the other story was, you know. And so I didn't really pay much attention to it at the time because I didn't really know that it was going on. And then when I was in the Command and General Staff College at Fort Leavenworth, Kansas, General Hodges, who was at the time the U.S. Army Europe commander, he came and he was the speaker, and there's this big hall at Fort Leavenworth, Eisenhower Hall. It holds like 2,000 people. And so he gave this presentation. You know, and this would have been 2015, late 2015-ish. Mm. And he started talking about everything that we're talking about. And really? I was like, yeah. what, what the hell is he talking about? I've never even heard of this. You know, he talked about the strike at Zelenopilia that was kind of like one of the early starts of everything.
That was bad.
Yeah, he started laying out all these, you know, like the Battle of Ilovaisk, Donetsk Airport, and I was like, what is going on? And so that's what perked my interest in this, and it's because it was underreported, perhaps because it was inconvenient. And the only time that it really got a lot of attention was when MH17 was shot down by Gherkin and his boys.
Yeah, I mean, look, 2014 was a really, I think we sort of forget, an incredibly busy news year. Not that really should make a difference, but you had the revolution in Ukraine, you had the Malaysia flight that disappeared, you know, over the Indian Ocean. You had obviously Crimea then, and then you had obviously things starting in Donbass. You had MH17, but then you had Gaza 2014, and then you had the Islamic State, which obviously took up a lot of attention towards the latter half of that year. So I think, yeah, there was a lot going on that year. I covered three of those conflicts. But I think it was the war in the Donbass was a complex one. As I said, there was a lot of fog of war. It wasn't like the easiest story to tell. I'm definitely not saying that that's a good reason to not cover it in depth, but I think ultimately I felt that some outlets just couldn't really commit to it, whereas we really decided that, you know, this is a story that is not, it didn't start in April, May 2014. It started in December 2013. You know, this is all connected to the revolution and events in Crimea. This is Russia resurgent, and this is Ukraine kicking back and trying to forge its own path and being denied that. And so we felt that this is a story that we needed to really stick with. And, you know, you go on the YouTube, I don't even know how many dispatches we got up to from that, that Ukraine series, but hundreds, definitely.
No, that's all good. That's one of the things, like, so you talked about it was a hard story to tell. And so is somebody that's written a lot about this conflict and about the portions of the conflict. It's been like, I published a paper on the Battle of Ilovaisk in 2021, I think. And it took me that long to piece together enough information to try and tell a narrative of what happened. Because I had tried to previously do that, and it was just, the information was so disparate, and it was so hard to connect things in a way that flowed logically. And I had the same thing. I had published a paper on the Battle of Donetsk Airport in 2019, and I tried to write that one back in like 2017, but it was just so hard to find information, and it took a lot of time for that information to kind of streamline itself into something that could be used to patch together to build a narrative, to tell the story. And that's what I think is useful about it too, is it's not just telling the story for the story's sake, but it's telling the story so that you know, governments, policymakers, practitioners, NGOs that do all the work on the back end when things have gone sideways and have to help rebuild these cities and help these people, so they understand what's coming. That's, you know, a big part of the reason of doing the writing isn't to say, hey, look, here's this, you know, the Russians fight in this idiotic way and it's, you know, it's dumb and we're better than them. No, it's not that at all. It's, hey, next time Russia invades Ukraine, you can expect this to happen. And so perhaps we should prepare for that on the front end and not just be reactionary and throw our hands up on the back end.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, there were so many lessons from the fighting in Donbass that were just not learned and were sort of unfortunately ignored in many ways, which, you know, we're paying the price for that now. And the Ukrainians, more than anyone, are paying that price, unfortunately.
Yeah. So with the last question on the battles, is there anything about Debaltseve that you wanted to highlight?
That
one sounded miserable when you do the research, because of the time of year it was and the weather.
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely was almost the word I was going to reach for. It was cold, really cold. You know, I think some days it reached minus up maybe down to minus 20, you know. Is kind of damp as well, really miserable. You know, it got dark early, obviously, that time of year. And it felt very, the atmosphere was sour. You know, I think the fall of the airport was a low moment. You know, obviously there's a lot of reverence around the fighters in there, deservedly so.
Yeah.
For the cyborgs, you know, that was just incredible feats of bravery and you know, military prowess, really. Yeah. And I think the loss of that symbolic position at the airport was a bit of a blow. And you know, I think there was more of an accepted understanding that Russia was fully involved here.
Yeah,
and that was, you know, that was ultimately terrifying. And I think the situation in Debaltseve was poor from the start. You know, it was not a good spot to be in, surrounded on three sides, I think. And, you know, there was a very isolated road in and out of the town that we traveled a couple of times that was, you know, really terrifying. You know, I think we were pretty lucky to kind of avoid any accurate shell and sniper fire. And, you know, the situation in the city itself was incredibly miserable. Lots of terrified civilians, you know, desperate for evacuation. That was not particularly well organized, I have to say. You know, there were people adamant that they wanted to stay for whatever reason, despite, you know, having to say, look, you know, this town is about to, you know, this is not, we're not close to how bad it's going to get here. You need to leave. You know, if you want to come back at a later time, do your thing. But right now, you do not want to be here. But people were adamant they wanted to stay. You know, there's no water in some parts of the city. You know, it's a really miserable, basically almost a full siege. And it just, there was an overwhelming sense of negativity around that battle. And obviously, Ukrainian government and senior military figures got a lot of stick for how they handled that. But, you know, this was an army that, you know, less than a year before could barely field, you know, a few thousand troops in any meaningful, efficient way. So I don't think they were ever really going to be able to kind of mount some sort of complex defense. You know, Ukrainians were very lucky that they are such brave and capable fighters. You know, exemplified by the cyborgs at the airport. But yeah, Debaltseve just was always a really difficult, challenging situation. That
we also always... had a worn out Ukrainian army that was also heavily dependent on volunteer battalions. That's the thing that I think a lot of folks overlook in this discussion too, is so much of the Ukrainian force wasn't the army per se. It was volunteer battalions that were put together and sent in to fight. And at this time they're fighting a significant number of Russian regular forces, you know, and so the fact that they were able to hold out for a month or so there in the city, and fight them to the degree that they did is pretty astounding, I think.
Yeah, agreed. I mean, you know, they were, the amount of shelling was really intense. I think probably the worst they'd seen up to that point.
Yeah.
You know, facing, you know, up to date Russian MBTs and other vehicles. And yeah, just as we now see, you know, from post 2022, you know, the Russian way of warfare is to flatten everything in front of them and move in. And, you know, very few forces, I think, would be capable of putting up much of a resistance to that, especially as overwhelming as it was around Debaltseve. But, you know, we met some very brave soldiers and civilians who were trying their best to hold out and help their fellow citizens in that moment. It just was bleak. It was tough. Have to say, I kind of came away from that one feeling pretty morose and dejected. It was very challenging.
Yeah. So that Debaltseve was the essentially the capstone on that Donbass campaign, if you will. And Minsk II was signed shortly after that. And that was any sort of real ceasefire, but. I say that to say, based off what you experienced during your time reporting there, were you surprised that Russia reinvaded Ukraine in February 2022?
Absolutely not. No. I think it was always felt like there was unfinished business here, that Minsk II was barely worth the paper it was written on. You know, only a few months after Minsk II, I was in Ukraine documenting how useless this supposed ceasefire was, you know. Shelling as soon as we arrived in Donetsk, and you know, both sides were having a go at each other. It was more static, you know. but you know, the positions were pretty fixed, obviously, but it wasn't stopping them trying to still kill each other. And civilians, again, caught in the middle, you know, front lines running through villages on the outskirts of Donetsk, you know, really, you know, really difficult places to be. And I think it just always felt like there would be a moment that this would blow open again. And I think, you know, the warning signs in 21 were there quite early on in the spring, you know, troop buildup on the border. But again, there was that, I was getting that same feeling on the diplomatic front that this was an inconvenience, something to, let's just kind of forget that this is happening and not take it that seriously. Of course, you know, they won't invade, you know, it would be madness or whatever adjective they want to use to describe the situation. But, you know, again, just not learning the lessons from 2014, 2015. He already invaded, you know, Putin already invaded Ukraine, you know, Crimea, like, yeah, Donetsk Airport, Debaltseve, Ilovaisk. Like, what more evidence do you need to see that this is more than possible, you know, more than likely? I guess the one thing I was not surprised by was, you know, the Ukrainian talent for resistance, battlefield ingenuity and real genuine bravery and courage, which clearly the Russians had not learned those lessons from 2014 and 15. You know, from my reporting experience in Ukraine and other countries, it's always foolish to underestimate your opponents if they're engaged in an existential conflict. You know, you could not ask for greater motivation. You know, it's the absolute kind of flip reverse of you know, Russian soldiers and convicts or whoever's, you know, fighting for them these days. You know, what motivation do they truly have to be fighting in Ukraine beyond sort of the flimsiest, ridiculous of propaganda and, you know, some sort of monetary value? But yeah, I just think it does not surprise me that the Ukrainians were able to deal so many embarrassing blows that continue, obviously, to this day. You know, you just have to look at, you know, the sinking of that corvette, you know, last week, a week before, the kind of drone capability striking Russian oil infrastructure hundreds of miles away from Ukraine, the sort of the fights around Kyiv, Bucha and Irpin, the fight for Hostomel Airport, Snake Island. Like, it's, you could, you, I could do this all day. And that is down to Ukrainians just not having any of it, for want of a better phrase. Like, you know, no. And I think that that underestimation of that has been the downfall of Russian strategy in Ukraine. I think they've learned some of those lessons, but clearly they're still refusing to learn from others and keep making brutal mistakes that cost, obviously, their soldiers' lives, but plenty of civilians in Ukraine and Ukrainian soldiers too.
I think back, to build on what you said, I think back to the beginning of the conflict, and there was that Ukrainian woman who came up to that Russian soldier that was standing on the street corner, and she said something to the effect of, "Take these seeds so that you plant or so that you become sunflowers when you're killed here in Ukraine," or something to that effect. I know I'm butchering what she said, but at the time I remember thinking that's very optimistic, because this was like days into the conflict. And you know, like, I reflect back on that every now and then when I think about this conflict and how, you know, despite the state of the conflict right now, where it's essentially, you know, deadlocked along that contact line from Donetsk down through the land bridge to Crimea, or the Donbass, I'm sorry, down through all that. And like, it could be a lot worse. And I think that woman's attitude really helped signify the Ukrainian attitude towards this whole thing. And it's been really refreshing to see.
100%. And it, you know, moments like that. But then there were so many, you know, videos really early on, February, March, you know, 22, of Ukrainian civilians just standing in front of tanks and armored vehicles. Multitudes of tank man from Tiananmen Square. I mean, just, I mean, almost deranged levels of bravery. But again, something that did not surprise me either. So, yeah, I think obviously situation right now is challenging for Ukrainian soldiers. especially in regards to artillery ammunition. Yeah. But what they've been able to achieve in protecting their country and the rest of Europe ultimately should not be underestimated. And I think the next few months are going to be interesting, especially around Avdiivka.
Going back to the reinvasion question and comments that you made, I think it's, I was not surprised either. The writing was on the wall. And if you know anything about Russian, I don't even know what the right word is. I would say history, but it's more propaganda. Those two things are interwoven. And the way Russia's worldview of Ukraine, where they don't really view it as a state, they don't really view Ukrainians as a separate people. They view them as a as brothers or cousins, but a second tier brother or cousin. And, you know, so I was never surprised, and I always was expecting that to come back. And what was interesting is at one point when I was getting approval for a presentation that I did, or a different presentation that I did, and it was on Russia-Ukraine, I talked about the Battle of Ilovaisk as a case study within that presentation. And conference was at the end of February, so right before or right after the invasion started, but I was getting approval beforehand. And when I was presenting the stuff that I was going to present, and I was saying, hey, this is what I'm going to present, I'm going to make sure it's okay. Mm-hmm. They said, oh yeah, Ukraine, that's so, what was it? That's so 8 years ago. And like 10 days later, I kid you not, 10 days later, you know, Russia reinvades. And I'm like, if you think that this was like a one and done, you're foolish at best, and you don't understand the international relations aspect of Russia-Ukraine, especially over time. If you've got you know, time, and you understand how Russia and Ukraine have interacted with each other for eternity, you know. Go ahead.
You're very right. You know, there's a real chauvinistic. There's obviously there's a chauvinistic attitude by Russia towards Ukraine, especially from Putin. And Putin has remarked on a number of times about his feelings towards Ukraine.
Yeah, he's made it plain.
I think, again, it's that there was an interest in not taking that seriously within certain diplomatic circles. And I think that's, you know, it's always a mistake. You've got to take people at face value as much as you can and listen to what they're telling you. This was telegraphed, this whole series of events. It's kind of too late now, but I do hope that moments like this show that just because it's the 21st century and doesn't mean that like big land wars and devastating urban conflicts are behind us as some relic of the of the 20th century. We all, I think, again, the royal we, you know, expected that in Europe at least that was going to be left behind post the Balkan conflicts, but you know, it didn't take very long to come back. And I think we need to remind ourselves that the worst can and often will happen. Look at the pandemic. Would anyone, you know, if you told people in 2019, 2018 that this huge global pandemic was going to strike and it was going to upend the globe, most people would have just not taken you seriously. But it happened, and it did. And it's the same with conflicts. I think, you know, we should expect that there's a potential for, you know, Israel's war on Gaza to spill out and to become a wider conflict. You know, we should, governments around the world should be preparing for that possibility and the impact that that will have. The worst can and will always happen. And I think if you ask the average Ukrainian, they will know that the hard way, unfortunately.
Yeah. So I think that that's a good place to wrap up. Well, Henry, thank you very much. And again, for the listeners, if you go on YouTube, you can find all the reporting that Henry did and his colleagues, because it's Henry plus a handful of other colleagues that did reporting over the course of this whole thing. And basically from start to end, I'm using air quotes on end because it didn't really end. And if you go on YouTube, you look up Vice News, and it's the series on there is called Russian Roulette, and there's just a ton of videos are numbered sequentially. So if you want to work your way through how the whole thing unfolded, you can do that. And there's some fascinating stuff in there. And one of the I guess on my end to close, one of the fascinating things that I saw when I went back and was looking at some of those videos to prepare for this was there was an interview with one of the DNR guys, and I don't remember if it was you or one of your colleagues, but the question was essentially, is this over? And this was like towards the end. It was like after Debaltseve or something, or right at the tail end. And the guy said, no, 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 Russia will come back. And he said, Russia, you know, and he was a DNR fighter, you know, so he knew what was up, you know, whether he knew, which I doubt he did, or if he just had a really good assumption, which I think a lot of us that were paying attention probably had. Exactly. So anyway, I think that that's the important thing, is we can't just cast aside. And I think that that's one of the themes that I've pulled away from our conversation today, is you can't cast aside inconveniences because they don't align with how you want to view the world, how you want to view conflict. You have to really look at the past, even the, you know, not the far past necessarily, recent past will sometimes point to what's going to happen tomorrow. And so anyway, with that, again, thank you very much, Henry, for your time. I appreciate it.
No worries. Thank you, Amos.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.